which is 48. Is this going to be a letdown, do you think? This is on another subject, and it's a dilly. It's on war. Why'd we have to bother about that? We're beyond that sort of barbarism today, aren't we? Well, I think I can save trouble by reading the introduction to a section on war. I have 42 pages on strategy and tactics in the Book of Mormon here. Recently, they had a symposium. I've got to see if I can get a copy of it. A symposium on military action in the Book of Mormon. Not military action, on strategy and tactics. I mean, it was on the art of war and fortification and so forth in the Book of Mormon, which is very sophisticated in that. 170 pages devoted to war of all that. And here I notice in the book I got 42 pages on the military, just on the strategy and tactics. And the best excuse, I think, is in the introduction here. But I say here that the readers of the Book of Mormon sometimes are disgusted with all this preoccupation with these. We talked about the sordid business, all the political finagling, and the systematic assassinations launched by Amalickiah. That's not a very pleasant story. And now we come to this. Now we come to the actual engagements. And we say here that after having survived 3 years military intelligence at every level, that is it, you see. Now, we talked about our four civilizations, remember? Remember how they act in war? How does number one do? How do the brothers do good? They flee, remember? They're Rechabites. They flee to the desert. They do it time and again in the Book of Mormon. They break off and go off by themselves. Sometimes they get overrun and so forth. And, of course, number three, the warlords, war is their business. And they fight until they exhaust, not themselves, but until they exhaust their material. Then I say they settle around along the edges. And that's what you find, of course, around the periphery of Asia, both in China and everywhere else. And you notice today, they extend so far, and then the bubble breaks. And all the places, the fringe of the Russian Empire today, we call it empire, Estonia, Lithuania, and so forth, and Turkey and Armenia on one side, and the Tartars on the other side, and Mongolian Russian on the other. Everywhere people are crying for independence. Now they break off, you see, the empire, and then it's going to have to start all over again. Of course, it's doing the same with our far-flung bases. You see, everywhere the nations want to take their bases back, they want to kick us out, whether it's in the Philippines or in Greece or in Spain or in even Australia and New Zealand. They say, nothing doing. They won't have nukes there, for example. And loosening the hold on these bases. Do we have any business trying to hold all those bases anyway, is the point. But see, that's the central thing. That's your warlords. This is the way they do. They make war with their resources, but they also, of course, the thing is that you get along with the people that are conquered almost immediately. That's the whole idea. Well, we won't go into Clausewitz on this occasion. But then there's number two. That's Babylon. How do they do? Well, they have professional armies do their fighting, of course. They have regular professional soldiers, and they stay home. This is marvelously illustrated. We're soon to come to a chapter on this, where in a bitter letter, Moroni is just fit to be tied. He's so angry at these people back home that have never had it so good while the army is suffering out there, and that's the way it happens. So you ask, well, why does this insanity keep up? Why haven't we made any progress at all since the Book of Mormon? Why do people... while we're as determined to make war as ever. Well, it's profitable. It's enormously profitable. And say, what do you think? Here, my business for all of 1944, which is the most active part, was battlefield intelligence. I had to immediately find out what the Germans were up to and report it to where it could be the most good. In the end, it went right up to Schaeff. But first of all, it had to be used at division level, then at corps, then at armies, and at army group, then at Schaeff finally. But the stuff I got was considered invaluable, pure gold. There was only one team that did that, a three-man team. And of course, the first two were killed on D-Day, and that left me as a one-man team. So I had to snoop into everything. And I found out all sorts of things I shouldn't have found out. The whole thing was being run as a game for profit. It's a marvelous thing. But then after that, all of 1945, I had my own Jeep. The officers couldn't drive, Jason, because gentlemen don't drive. And they were very strict about that in the ETO. See? So everybody was jealous because I had my own Jeep and I could get all the gas I wanted anywhere, and gas was pure gold. But I had to drive all over Germany and France, Austria, Luxembourg, Netherlands, and Belgium, interviewing snooping into things and all the time finding out things I shouldn't be finding out, I suppose. And I tell you, the whole thing was run from the beginning. It was run, operated, controlled, and orchestrated by the same interests on both sides. If you want a good enlightenment on that, read a book by the chief judge at Nuremberg, Joseph Borkin. It's called The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. I.G. Farben was up to all sorts of things. It acted hand in glove. It shared their secrets and their profits with Standard Oil of New Jersey, which became the beloved Exxon, see, later on. But they had an equal part on both sides in the war. And I say, I can tell you stories that would amaze the faculties of eyes and ears, chill your young blood, cause every particular hair to stand on end as the fretful porcupine. He calls it, of course, it's porcupine, and pig with spines on it, you see. But porpentine is what it is in the old. But so that's why we're going to continue to have wars, and it's bigger business now than ever, as you know. What, after all, Brother Quayle spilled the beans the other day when he said we knew all along that Star Wars was a dream, but there are enormous profits in it, you see. It's not going to work. Not for a long time, at least. But look at the money. Look at the contracts you have in it. So it's going to go on. And here we go, still operating. Well, let's see what the man says here, Mr. Infallible. So we say, with frequent visits from Army Group, with frequent visits to Schaeff on the one hand, exciting times there, and the foxhole on the other, of course. And reading thousands of written reports, and then every day I had to make reports all the time when they came in, and then after that, of course, in 45, I was from first to third Army and then to sixth Army Group, and then I was making reports for the whole front at that time. That was very enlightening, too. We have always been inclined to rush through the military parts of the Book of Mormon as painful reminders of an unpleasant past. But, and I've studiously ignored the war stories myself, well, skip the wars, I said. Alas, alas, if we only could, you see. The whole point is Alma's, or rather Moroni's, studies of the work of death, as he calls it. They're supposed to be revolting. They are meant to be painful. It is Mormon Moroni, the tragic survivors of the nation destroyed by senseless war. Remember, always this theme of destruction. Why can't you leave that alone? The Book of Mormon is about as negative as you get, isn't it? Well, there must be some reason for that. Don't you get the hint? Why do you think people don't like to read the Book of Mormon? Why do you think we rush through it? We take speed reading courses so it won't slow us down. Or else we pick our way through it daintily, as through a minefield, as I say, avoiding all the unpleasant passages, of which there are plenty. And that will get you through the Book of Mormon in no time, if you leave out all the unpleasant passages you don't like. And they're editing this book, and they put into it whatever they think might be useful as a warning to us. It's not their purpose to tell an entertaining or reassuring tale, or as anything but glamorous in the Book of Mormon. The campaigns and battle are described not as a writer of fiction would depict ancient warfare with all its excitement and color, somebody writing in New York, early America, New England, and so forth. Be popular, right? Well, Mark Twain or somebody would write about it. All that well of the New England school, vitamin C, before I choke to death, otherwise I have to get water. No, it is not that of an author of the Americas of the 1820s would imagine, as the gaudy trappings of heroic daring do, all missing. It's a real war as we see it here, a tedious, sordid, plotting, joyless, routine, seesaw succession, losses and gains, brutally expensive, destructive, exhausting, and boring, with constant marches and countermarches that end sometimes in fiasco, sometimes in intensely unpleasant engagements. The author writes as one would write, as only one could write, who had gone through a long war as a frontline observer with his eyes wide open. Everything is strictly authentic, with the proper emphasis in the proper place. Now, it treats strategy and tactics treated with the knowledge of an expert, logistics and supply, armaments and fortifications, recruiting and training, problems with morale and support from the home front, military intelligence from cloak and dagger to scouting and patrolling, interrogation, guarding, feeding, and exchange of war prisoners, propaganda, psychological warfare, rehabilitation and resettlement. All these things are there and definitely treated deftly and explicitly. Feelers for peace, negotiations at various levels, treason, profiteering, the exploitation of the war economy by individuals and groups, it's all there. Mormon and his son are summing up the situation after spending most of their lives, the part we're coming to later, in the field, and they hate it. For war, for them, war is nasty, brutalizing, wasteful, dirty, degrading, fatiguing, foolish, immoral, and above all, unnecessary. It is also inevitable, as long as men are running things, and as long as it's very profitable, you see. Well, so we get this Book of Mormon war business, and that's why we're going to be bothered with it. I say if this was all behind us now, but alas, how much more is before us? Of course, you see, the nukes are going to change all that. Not if it's more profitable not to use the nukes. So we start out the chapter here, and first the relevance, DC 1, Doctrine and Covenants 1, verse 35, remember where it tells us, the time is not now, but is near at hand, when peace shall be taken away from the earth, and the devil will have control of his own dominion, which is war, of course. Peace is going to be taken away. Is there any place which is relaxed and peaceful today? Everywhere is in tension. How is this going to break out? How is it going to be solved? But the chances of coming to peaceful and friendly agreements based on love, brotherhood, charity, and all that sort of thing get fainter and fainter all the time, don't they? So that's the age you happy people are living in. I'm glad I'm clearing out. Well, so we start out with public relations, and Amalickiah was a public relations genius. He knew how to get people behind. We have to get them behind you in the war, and he's going to do it. Notice how he does it, very cleverly. Notice how far the Book of Mormon is ahead of the times here. Amalickiah has obtained the kingdom. He's got what he wants. Thou hast it now, all, you see. Now, what are you going to do? What's your next step? Oh, but you got to get the Nephites under your thumb, too. Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to bring people into bondage? This is another very interesting thing, isn't it? He's going to tell us here why. Well, we'll get to that in just a second here. But first of all, he began to inspire the hearts of the Lamanites against the people. You see, you have to get the warlike, you have to get them angry, you have to get them a reason. You're not, remember, they've been very reluctant. They didn't want to do this. He's formed his army. He's got, without any fighting at all, see, the reason he got the loyalists together with the opposition on Mount Antipas there, they surrounded him and they said, well, let's get together here. And they're following Amalickiah. Amalickiah gets himself made king by treason, as you know how. And then he's got it all. Now he's got to make real war. And so the first thing is to put the people in mind for it. Give them the fighting spirit and so forth. Make them want it, because that's the only reason he's able to get what he wanted so far, is that they didn't want to fight. They'd do anything rather than that. And so now he's got them where he wanted. Now his big problem, how can we make the next step? And to inspire the hearts of the Lamanites against the people of Nephi, he did appoint men to speak unto the Lamanites from their towers against the Nephites. Notice they have these towers. Notice how often the Book of Mormon talks about these towers. And of course, when you go to Central America or the Mississippi Valley, for that matter, wherever the old Indian cultures are, or for that matter, you go to the Hopis. After all, what is a Hogan? But it's a step pyramid. It's a reduced step pyramid. Some of the Hogan say the big one at Otavilla, for example, you have the steps going up to it and all the rest. Some of them are quite high, low, and you have the ladder and the rest. So they have their towers, and these towers are, what do they use them for? Some of them are absurd. They just stand there, and they, with these high, steep steps, they can be climbed all right. Why wear yourself out? Going up 150 steps, this high thing down there, is nothing on the top. Are they all remiumptums? You see, some of them certainly were. But they're for announcements. They're always, of course, at ceremonial places. And remember Alma, when Alma and Amulek went, they preached at such a place, been built. And they were for public assemblies and announcements and for preaching and all the rest. But he had this systematically done from towers, you know. He as it were, we would say, he had time on the air. He had all these stations. It was saturated the air with this. He used this sort of modern technique. That a broadcasting stations, he had these towers spread throughout the whole country, and they're the same thing as if you had broadcasting centers or stations. So that's what he did. And he appointed speakers with their set talks. Remember, this is exactly what you do in public relations. You have you take a sample and you find out what will sell, and then your people give that spiel. And you hear the same program over and over again, and you think, well, people would get wise after a time, but the funny thing is they don't. I'm going to give you a talk on rhetoric one of these days, because it plays a very important part in the Book of Mormon. But here, people are, if you just keep saying it, it may be a lie, it might be absurd, it may be unthinkable. Keep at it, and they'll go for it. You know, they found that out. I mean, you've had the same slogans going for years and years. And so, thus he did inspire the hearts that it got to them. After all, if you have the guy shouting through the megaphone all day long, and you hear the same message over and over again, you give in to it. And so, they inspired the hearts of the Nephites, insomuch that at this particular time, that about the 19th year, they were willing to, having been made king over them, sought also to reign over all the land. That was the idea, all the people of the Nephites as well as the Lamanites. He was, why would he want to rule everybody? Remember Alexander the Great, who wept because there were no more worlds to conquer? As long as there's something left to conquer, you've got to do it, you see. And it's the same thing with the Romans, as we said. Agar Hosticus and Agar Pacatus, the pacified earth, Dar el Islam and Dar al Harb. The outer world, anything that hasn't submitted to you has to be conquered, has to be taken because it's a threat. You can't even sleep at night because these people haven't been conquered yet and they pose a threat to you. And so you have to expand your world empire till everybody's knuckling under you, yes. Insignem pietatum, how does it go in the fourth eclogue? Oh, darn, let me see, how do those lines go? Yes, imperio cano famam qui terminat astris. That's what we have to achieve. Our rule has to reach to the oceans as far as you can go, and our fame must reach to the stars. Imperio cano qui terminat. Our fame which reaches, terminates at the stars, terminat astris. So this is the idea. And so there is no satisfaction to you, and you rule everything, you see, and then you weep like Alexander because there are no more worlds to conquer. Of course, this was Nimrod. He wanted to be a cosmocrator. There's an interesting phenomenon. It's very important in the life of Abraham, the Book of Abraham, and in the Pearl of Great Price, in the Book of Moses. Cosmocrator is somebody who simply rules the world, has conquered the world. And there's been 10 cosmocrators, we're told. There have been the three great ones, of course, Alexander and Nimrod. And, well, you have your pick of the others, but men who aspired to rule over everything, of course. Caesar wanted to be that, but... And, well, he had accomplished his design. The first part was to harden the hearts of the Lamanites so they'd be willing. And in order to do that, you had to tell them lies. You had to blind their minds, he said. Then you stir them up to anger. This is the process, isn't it? Win, win, win. Why do people act this way? Book of Mormon says, well, why do we? We're guilty of the same thing. First, you harden their hearts. Then they don't want to listen to the facts. You blind their mind. And then they get emotional about it. You get all wrought up and we're all ready for war. It's the silliest thing in the world, but we do it. That's Hitler's great... Hitler was very skillful of that. He was working for the corporations, but he knew how to pull it off, doing that very thing. And, of course, he used the radio exactly today, and as we use the TV, it's the same thing, and as he used the towers, the systematic tower. There's a very good book by Richard Nixon on that subject called The Real War, on this very subject, how that's done. Well, he was determined, we say, because of the greatness of the number of his people, see, it turned his head to see his power and glory, to overpower the Nephites and bring them into bondage. I say, why would he want to bring them into bondage? Well, submission is the only form of obedience that a person like that could understand. They wouldn't obey unless they submit, would they? Wouldn't obey willingly. That's what Islam means, submission. But submission to God, submission to anybody else, you see, is wrong. That's what he calls bondage. If you submit to God, that's dandy. But if you submit to anybody else. And of course, that's the story of Nimrod. Remember Nimrod, you had Noah, then you had Ham, then you had Cush, and Cush's son was Nimrod. Nimrod was a righteous young man until he was 25 years old, and he became the king, and he had received the garment of Adam, which had been stolen by Ham when they were leaving the ark. It belonged to Adam, and Noah had it. We mentioned that garment before, you see, but there's great literature about this garment. Because of that garment, when he wore it, they lost it later on, all the animals, all people assumed that he had was a holy man and a priest and acting for God, and they submitted to him willingly. And that was right. But then it turned his head, and he decided to become the great conqueror. Meanwhile, God gave him the bow as a protection to protect the human race against the depredations of the giant animals and creatures that roamed the earth in those days, cave bears, mastodons, and things like that, which man was not able to cope with at all in his helpless state until God gave Nimrod the secret of the bow and arrow, and a very sophisticated, a very efficient weapon, more efficient than any rifle. You read a book called by Saxton Pope called Hunting with the Bow and Arrow. He wrote in Berkeley years ago. Excellent book showing that the bow and arrow is the most efficient of all weapons in hunting or anything else. It's not only silent, but it makes a wound. A stone arrowhead makes abrasions of the wound. It stops. It starts hemorrhages, which don't stop. Even if you hit an animal in not in a vital place at all, in the end, it has a fatal effect. And there's so many advantages to hunting with a bow and arrow. They try them again. Well, for one thing, they shot. It happened. Experiments were made in Berkeley. They shot with high-powered rifles into hanging hams and sides of beef and so forth to see which would penetrate. And the arrow penetrated more effectively than most high-powered bullets. It's great stuff. The other things I say, it's silent, it's cheap, and all sorts of things. But anyway, God gave the arrow to Nimrod to defend the human race, to protect their enemies. It didn't take Nimrod long to discover that he could use these arrows to put the human race at his disposal. He was put at his disposal to defend the human race. Now he discovered that if he turned it against the human race, they were at his disposal. He was the boss. And this is the famous arrow of Nimrod, the bow of Nimrod. He turned it. In the end, he went crazy and turned it against God, and he challenged God to a fight because he was ruler of the empire. He said, I'm the creator, I'm the God. He built the Tower of Babel, and he went up to the top of it so he could shoot arrows into the sky and kill God. And the angel Gabriel, playing a trick on him, held up a fish, and the arrow hit the fish and came back covered with blood. And then Nimrod went stark raving mad. He said, see, I've killed God. There's blood on the arrow and so forth. Well, there are various versions of this story. I know, but it's very old and it circulates everywhere. And so he went nuts. And so to get rid of him, God finally, to show his utter contempt, dispatched him with the weakest and smallest of creatures. He sent a little tiny gnat, and it crawled up the nose of Nimrod and started tickling his brain. Well, of course, it drove him absolutely crazy. He couldn't stop. He had two servants stand on each side of him with hammers and hit him on the head alternately so he wouldn't be tickled to death by it. It was just driving out of his head. And so if they hit him on the head, he went brong. So that would be better than putting up with this gnat. In the end, that did away with Nimrod. So, but this is a great peer, and he's supposed to found the first army, the first city. He got civilization going. Now, this is class number two, Babylon. Nimrod, see, Nimrod is the father. He's the founder of Babylon. Ancient, all the old sources will tell you, wherever you get them, that Nimrod founded Babylon, good old Nimrod. So here we are, and he was the arch enemy of Abraham and so forth. And this is type number two. So, and he had to bring people into bondage. Nothing else would do, you see. Well, we say the same thing, make them say uncle. We're talking about small Central American countries. We'll make them say uncle. That amounts to do what we tell them to do. Who are they who dare to defy us and so forth? Well, now look what he does, that clever man. Verse 5, he appoints chief captains of the Zoramites. Now, you remember from last semester who the Zoramites were. They're people who went off by themselves. When very suddenly they had a brand new religion and everything else, so they had adopted some of the local, some of the prevailing, more ancient customs or religions that were in the country already. I think that's rather clear. That was from last semester. But they were, remember, Alma says, tells them they're just model people. They're smart, they're well-dressed, they have dress standards, they're very pious. Every Sunday they all bear their testimonies. They go up in the Ramayam to me, we thank God that we are a blessed people, we're not like other people, and so forth. And then he said they forgot about it the rest of the week. But he says they were the wickedest people he ever knew, because they cry unto thee, O God, and yet their hearts are upon their riches. Same thing. So these are the Zoramites, and they went out on the left. Remember, they left up, went out by themselves. And so now they're living along with in the area between the Nephites and Lamanites, and they're now absorbed by the Lamanites. Remember, they asked to become, at the beginning of the long war, they asked to become Lamanites. They were officially accepted as Lamanite citizens and stayed there. They didn't intermarry, though. But they were the smartest people, and they were the best warriors there were. They had the best officers, so they knew all the answers, and they had been Nephites, you see. As it tells us, the dissenters were the worst of all in the preceding chapters, remember, and they were dissenters. So they were the people to trust. He puts their captains in charge who knew what they were doing. And they knew all the weaknesses and all the strengths, and they knew the strategy and tactics of the Nephites. So he says he appointed chief captains of the Zoramites, they being the most acquainted with the strength of the Nephites and their places of resort and the weakest parts of their cities, exactly what you'd want to know if you were interrogating a prisoner of war, you know. What is this, and does anybody watch the gate, and is it these hours, when do they change the watch, and so forth. And the weakest parts of their cities, therefore, he appointed them to be the chief captains of the armies. Very shrewd, you see. The same thing is done by modern nations, remember, when they, well, rather by third world countries, when they invite observers from larger, stronger countries of both sides of the curtain, into Africa and Central America or anywhere else. They come as observers, but they come in strength, and before you know it, they are running the show, you see. And the same thing here, the Zoramites were there as observers, you might say, because they knew all the smarts. But they were the captains. They were the chief captains. They were the ones in charge of the operation. So he had a pretty good thing going. He knew what he was doing. So they took their camp to move toward the land of Zarahemla in the wilderness. Now, here's the contrast in 7. While Amalickiah had thus been obtaining power by fraud and deceit. Notice there, the Book of Mormon puts its thumb right on the thing. They know what it is. It's just, the whole darn thing is just fraud and deceit is what it is. It's been under the all this patriotic rhetoric they've been having, all this fervor against the wicked Nephites. They've robbed us. We're going to see what the argument was. They've robbed us of our birthright. They cheated and so forth, Laman and Lemuel. Were denied their rights, and the people really believed it. They really believed it, and they've been working on that. So it was, but it was fraud and deceit. Moroni, on the other hand, had been preparing the minds of the people. Their minds had to be prepared too, to go against the Lamanites, no, to be faithful to the Lord their God. That would take it of it. What care of a contrast? No hate campaigns here, you see. It was, oh, incidentally, the historian who said that, and he searched all the works of Lincoln and Lee, and they never mentioned the other side as the enemy, was Henry Steele Cominger. I remember just after the class, I apologize, but you can find it there. Now, that's interesting, there are no hate campaigns at all, and this is very strong in the idea of Moroni. The enemy he always refers to as our brethren. It's the only title he uses to describe the enemy as our brethren. It's rather strong. Well, now, he did a very clever thing. This morning, gentlemen, our lecture will be on defense in depth. And this is what this is on. This is a beautiful example of defense in depth. The Nazis, with great effect, the Germans launched in September 1938, launched World War II into Poland with great effect using the pincers movement, the blitzkrieg, the double arms. The blitzkrieg, first you would proceed with reconnaissance in force, which is much greater than our reconnaissance. We just used a squad, usually. But they used a whole regiment just for reconnaissance, just to scout out the land. They had heavily armed, so they practically had the battle won before they got there. And then they were followed up by the tanks and supported by, and followed immediately by the infantry. So, and when they struck, they didn't strike the main objective, they struck around the sides, and before they knew it, they were encircled. It was an encircling movement, and you had them trapped that way. And they worked that again and again. It worked almost every time. They worked in Belgium, they worked and they worked in, especially on the plains of Poland. So that's what Amalickiah was doing. He was going to blitz them, you see. Well, how do you slow down a blitz? You do it by defense in depth. You just put in a lot of little forts along here. Here's one, we got to, and here's one, and here's one, and here's one. Well, you might get through here all right and surround them, but you haven't taken them. You can't proceed. You cannot proceed unless you subdue them, because otherwise you're going to have them in your rear, and they'll cut off your supplies and everything else. You can't do a thing. These must be subdued one by one, and that always slows down the blitzkrieg. Never fails to work, because you have these little forts. You cannot feel safe and leave this behind, have this at your back, you see. You have to wipe it up. Or you send the main force to do that, but meanwhile you have to go up here and wait for them, and then you're exposed, because you all have to be together. It's a blitz, that means lightning. It has to move as fast as possible, and you have to be in there. And you notice the Lamanites do that again and again. Notice their attack is going to tell us in there, our surprise. Suddenly one morning they found the Lamanite armies were upon them, just like that. In the jungles you can get away with that too. So here he had his defense in depth, and notice how nicely it's described here. Yeah, he had strengthened the armies of the Nephites, erecting small forts or places of resort. It's exactly places to fall back on, you see. Throwing up banks of earth around. They didn't have the money or the time to build expensive places. And as I say, there were some very good papers. I think John Sorensen wrote a paper on the Nephite fortifications in view of the archaeological remains. And it's true, the earth forts were the commonest, you know, earth forts along the Mississippi Valley, all over the place. And then they could be improved by stone, and it was usual to have a timber palisade around the top, you see, to hold them, but not always here in this case. They add the timber a little later, I think, here. And small forts are places of resort, throwing up banks of earth around to enclose his army. And also he built walls of stone to encircle. See, they added the stone after the dirt. That's the, if you've got the time, you can do that. About them, around their cities and the borders of their land, Jay, all around the land. Notice, all around their, round about their cities, and in all the borders of their lands, he scattered these little forts everywhere so that the Amalekiah, the Lamanite forces couldn't do anything until they had to move with caution. It took all the steam out of the charge. They couldn't bowl through anymore. And in their weakest fortifications, he placed the greater number of men, which made them pretty equal. You see, you'd want to knock over a weak one quickly. All right, we'll give it special support. And thus he did fortify and strengthen the land which was possessed by the Nephites. It was their own country. And you'll notice throughout the Book of Mormon, it tells us in the Book of Mormon later, it tells us on exactly why that is. The battles are always fought on Nephite territory. They never invade outside. Interesting thing, American battles have always been fought outside. We've never had to do it inside. So we don't believe it really can happen in here because it's never happened to us. But remember, other countries, the wars have been fought inside of them again and again and again. That can be right. That means a different tactic, a different attitude to things. You're not so ready to go into it and so forth. Well, and here now we have remember the banners that they inscribed? These are the sentiments on the banners. You might call them buzzwords because they do excite an immediate reaction. They do stir up your emotion, like the side of the flag. It does, whether you know it's just emotional or not. It always does with me. The Star-Spangled Banner always makes me choke up. You say, I should be more rational than that. I'm sorry, that's the way it is. But support their liberty, their lands, their wives, their children, their peace, their God. The cause of the Christians. But you notice the thing about this, the intimate things they're supporting. They're not supporting their resources, their minds, their businesses, their vacations and things like that, but the things that are closest to them, their lands, their wives, their children, their peace, their God, the things that are intimate, you see. Those are the things that are worth supporting. What else do we... Well, so many wars have been on to gain a good harbor or to open this theory, the famous theory of the Trojan War, for example. And Troy had closed the straits through which Russian grain went through to the Mycenaean world. And Troy had to be subdued for the grain rights to let the wheat go through. And well, there's something to all of these. Most wars are fought for strategic reasons like that, for strategic gains. The past, now the Russians, the Crimean War, the Russians lack, their terrible lack, of course, is a warm water port. They're frozen in for the winter. Their navy can't operate in most places. That's why they fought the Sino-Japanese War. In the 1904, they had to take Port Arthur so that they would win, but the Japanese won that war. And so the reasons we give for going to war aren't these at all. To get ports, to get strategic routes. The Kaiser wanted Berlin to Baghdad. He wanted and what Hitler wanted and said repeatedly, he wanted the grain lands of the Ukraine. That's what he wanted, you see. There were economic reasons. We say wars are fought for economic reasons. But this is war of defense, you see. They're fighting for their lands, their wives, their children, their peace, their God, and so forth. Now, Moroni, here's the encomium of Moroni. We like what kind of a man he was, the character. A strong and mighty man, a strong character. There are few of them, but when they appear, they make the difference. What's his name? Carlyle's famous work on on the influence. Is history the influence of great men, or is it just the influence of... Remember, Tolstoy is, great men don't mean a thing. He talks about Napoleon, he talks about whoever is great. No, that's not it. It's the people, it's the mass, it's the general movement and so forth. It counts, the emotions of people. And yet, the strong man makes an awful lot of difference, doesn't he? After all, an Alexander and a Caesar, what a difference they make, you see. Or Thothmes III, or someone like that. Who is the equivalent? Well, Hitler is one man, yes. Yes, he's a man who counts for something. He was able to stir things up. You have to grant him that. But he was a strong and a mighty man, a man of perfect understanding. Well, now that's something else. A man, notice he always emphasizes this. He did not delight in bloodshed. A man whose soul did joy in liberty and the freedom of his country and his brethren from bondage and slavery, because they were actually threatened all the time. They were living. Remember, the Lord had been promised that they would... They would have to face this all the time. All the time. Are there people who actually delight in bloodshed? You bet there are. I remember one person, General Johnson. He was a general, only 25 years old, and he was Max Taylor's pet. Max Taylor was a division general, 101st at that time. He later became chief of staff. You know, in Washington, the big enchilada was Max Taylor. But when I knew him, we were quite... I can't say chummy because he was very aloof and so forth, but he talked with me a lot. And anyway, his pet was General Johnson. And when you get to be a general at 25, you must be pretty good. Well, he was all gung-ho, and so was Max Taylor gung-ho. They were just for doing it. That's why he had to have a paratroop division, all this sort of thing. And the night they left for Normandy, on the stage there was a big assembly hall and a big wooden building up at Ramsgate where they took off from, that field where they took off from. General Johnson jumps up on the stage with a trench knife in his mouth, his face blackened, of course. And he holds this up and says, "Do you see this knife? Before the night is over, it will be red with German blood." And then he left out the most hideous rebel yell you ever heard in your life. Well, why didn't he get to be chief of staff? Because he didn't last more than a couple of weeks. You start acting like that and you're finished, you see. He got himself bumped up. Well, it was not until it was in Holland. He and Taylor were standing on a canal, sizing up the territory just across toward Arnhem there. And along come some 88 shells and all fell flat. Everybody, not General Johnson. He stands up there proud as anything, and that finished General Johnson. He was too proud to fall flat on his face in the mud and the embankment. And so, boy, Taylor was fit to be tied that day. It was just like Achilles. He sat in the door of his tent and brooded. No one could go near him. He was. But there's what happened. But there are people. I mean, it's this. You get excited about this sort of thing. They love it. But his heart did swell with thanks. And notice he's a great-hearted man. His heart swelled with thanksgiving to his God. This is for the blessings they had. He doesn't complain and sorrow, worry about that, but he's just thrilled by how good God has been to them, how they've been blessed beyond their deserts. And his heart swells with this thanksgiving for the many blessings he'd bestowed on his people. He did labor exceedingly for the welfare and safety of his people. He had sworn an oath to defend his people with their... Notice, here's what we find on the banners of the Milkama, of the battle scroll, remember? To defend their rights, their country, their religion, even to the loss of blood. Notice that's a worst case. Extreme case is the loss of blood. As it says in the next verse, the Nephites were taught to defend themselves against their enemy, even to the shedding of blood, if it were necessary. Extreme worst case, hold back as long as you can, you see. And he emphasizes that. Yea, and they were also taught never to give an offense. And of course, today, nobody gives offense today. It was the Germans after World War I. They changed the name of the Kriegsschule to Wehrmacht. It wasn't the Kriegsschule, it was the War Department, you see. The Heeresmacht, the Army, the Wehrmacht, to Wehrmacht, to defense. And we took the hint and changed our war. It was always War Department in my day when I was in ROTC. It was War Department. Oh, no, it's not War Department. It's Department of Defense. Now, we just defend ourselves. We don't make war. It's all defense now, whether it's Army, Navy, or anything else, no matter what you do. It's defense. Because all nations have done that now. Because as Clausewitz says, that is routine. Every nation must claim in every war. Now, Clausewitz is the classic work, as you know, on the military. He's the teacher in all war schools. He taught the Germans in the 18th century, but his book became the Bible for strategy, tactics, and so forth. But you always claim, first of all, the title simply from Krieg, on war, Clausewitz on war. You must read it. But anyway, every nation thinks of itself as being on the defense, and no matter how ambitious you are, you must always approach your people with the attitude, they must defend ourselves, we are threatened, you see. That's the only way to get action. You never admit that you're an aggressor. You never do, of course. You're always, remember what Hitler said? In the midst of the deepest peace, we have been without provocation attacked. Hitler said that, speaking of Poland, when they smashed it in a week, you know. But it's because we have been attacked without any suspicion. Or he fooled Chamberlain that way. Everybody thought he'd be willing to settle if people just give him what he wanted, give him Austria, give him the Sudeten and so forth. He's a nice guy if he gave him just what he wanted. And it was true. He was sweet as pie. He was a nice guy if he got just what he wanted. Well, true with most of us. But and so you're on the defense. You always say, it's just the Defense Department today. But he really meant it. Because, as I say, every war in the Book of Mormon is fought on Nephite territory. When they finally turns that, as Mormon says in Mormon 4 and 5, he says, when we change that, that was the fatal mistake. Then we were finished. We didn't have a chance. Because when I saw against all that the Lord had commanded them that they would go against him, and then he says, surely the Lord, the justice of God will overtake the wicked. And it is by the wicked that the wicked are punished. Don't you try to punish anybody, he says. By the wicked. God wants the wicked to be punished, and he'll punish them, but he'll punish them by the wicked. So don't think it's the good guys against the bad guys at all. Whenever Nephites and Lamanites fight, they're equally bad. I say after that duel, personal duel between Amalekai and Moroni, just before this, where they fought face to face with a sword and ended that other war, you say, this is right out of Star Wars, the good guy is fighting the bad guy. And sure enough, Moroni appeals to God, and he's the victor and so forth. Then immediately after it says, then the people realized that all these troubles had come upon them because of their own sins, not because of the Lamanites. You see. Even in a clear, what you call a clear-cut case like that, in which it was good guys against bad guys. So here we are. So the shedding of blood, if it were necessary, yes, never to give offense, never to raise the sword, except it were against an enemy, except it were to preserve their lives. Joseph Smith said, I quote again, the man who carries a gun or a pistol will someday regret it. I have never carried anything more than a pen knife with me, a little tiny pen knife to sharpen a quill pen, you know. I have never carried anything larger than a pen knife with me, even when I face the mobs, he says. The man who carries a pistol or gun will, I don't know what happens if he carries an AK-47, an assault rifle that'll shoot 12 shells a minute. Well, you have to have those for hunting, of course. Well, those 12 bullets will really finish off a quail. You'd be surprised. He won't put up any fight after that at all. Well, there's a good story about fighting quails, but that's from Greece. We won't tell you that. This was their faith. You see, well, how can you do that? How can we expose ourselves? I mean, being a lot of wimps on the defensive like this, never to raise the sword, never to stand tall, except to preserve their lives. It was their faith in God. If they did that, God would preserve them. They put their faith in him. Well, what if he didn't? Well, he would. This is the point. If they were faithful in keeping the commandments. Now, that's the promise that had been given way back in the beginning. Already in the second chapter of the Book of Mormon, remember, it's given when the Lord tells Nephi that his people will always have the others breathing down their necks, but the unless they rebel against me also, is the second or third chapter, yes. Here it is, at the end of that second chapter. Inasmuch as this is fulfilling that promise that the Lord made to Lehi here, Lehi and his sons. Inasmuch as thou shalt keep my commandments, thou shalt be made a ruler and teacher over thy brethren. Nephi. Behold, in that day they shall rebel against me. I will curse them, even with a sore curse. They shall have no power over thy seed, except they shall rebel against me also. And if it so be that they rebel against me, they will be a scourge to thy seed, to stir them up in ways of remembrance. I want them always breathing down your neck. Don't think you can ever solve the problem by getting rid of the Lamanites. And they insist that that's the Lamanite problem. You can just go out there and knock them out, then we'll have it all made. And they come up against that again and again. Of course, they can't resist that. We're the same way today, you see. It's the John Wayne solution. The big man with the gun is the solution to the problem. And so they had to trust the Lord in that. Are we going to do it? Well, do we do it? No, we don't. And if they keep the commandments, he would prosper them in the land, and he would warn them to flee. See, fleeing is not a disgrace, they fled. Or to prepare for war according to their danger. One morning, going along a brick road, I turned aside because the headquarters, we were completely disrupted. We were getting out, and we lost our shirt in that apartment. And there was a little brick house by the road, and there was the whole headquarters company, the company, the general and the staff. They were all down on their knees praying. They were praying. We were surrounded at that time. That's the thing you do. Usually they were all drunk. Well, drinking, not exactly drunk, but on most landings, well, Colonel Coles was as drunk as the Lord when he landed in Holland. Took two pearl-handled revolvers in his hand and said, "Come out, follow me. Come here. Anybody who wants to follow me, I'll go up and take Sertogenbosch." Sertogenbosch was 5 miles away. It was never taken at all. That was the last ever heard of Colonel Cole, and he was the gung-ho. He commanded the 502nd. That was the best, the crack regiment we had. And Colonel Holdeser was never heard from again, because he did that silly thing, you see. But he was stewed. He'd been drinking too much, and he took these two pistols and said, "Come and follow me, you so-and-so. I'll take Sertogenbosch." Some of them did, and never heard her again. So that's the sort of thing we have here. The Lord will warn you, he said, to defend yourself. Prosper them and warn them to flee or prepare for war according to their danger. He would let them know. Notice the Rechabite brotherhoods, as we mentioned, were always fleeing anyway, Nephi and Lehi and all the rest of them. Well then, also God would make it known unto them whither they should go to defend themselves, whither they should go again, against their enemies, and by so doing the Lord would deliver them. That was their due line. We don't talk about the due line anymore. We had this elaborate system of radar defenses all around the periphery of the United States, up at Canada and Alaska and so forth, called the due line. It doesn't exist anymore. I guess it didn't need it. It was a big thing. But the Lord will tell you, he's your due line, he's your line of defense, to defend themselves against the enemy. By so doing, the Lord would deliver them. And this was the faith of Moroni. He is a most unusual general, to say the least. Not in the shedding of blood, but in doing good, in keeping the commandments of God. This is, again, it keeps repeating that. He did not like to shed blood. Firepower is not the solution, strange as it may seem. We found that out during the war. Look, that's what strategy and tactics are for. Strategy is to save lives, not to. And what were we reduced to in Vietnam? A completely bankrupt strategy, body count. Well, the whole purpose of strategy is not to have body count, not to lose anybody if you can possibly help it on either side. Because as Clausewitz says, the whole purpose of your fighting is to have the enemy submit to your will. Once he has, the war is over. Not to kill him necessarily. There's always no such thing as unconditional surrender. He'll surrender only on condition of his life being saved. So it's got to happen. Sooner or later, you've got to come to an agreement. The thing that stunned me, didn't stun me, surprised me, was the one day after May the 7th, 1945, when we signed the agreement up in Reims, we and the Germans became just buddy buddies, just like that. We're the best of friends. That had already been going on for some weeks before, because I was in old missionary territory for me. I was talking it up with the people who were chilling with the soldier, and well, that's fraternizing, that's dangerous as far as that goes. But no, there was no hard feelings or anything like that, not at all. I mean, after all, the business was interrogation of prisoners of war, battlefield prisoners who were willing, shocked, undone, were willing to tell you anything you wanted to know, and sometimes embarrassing, they wanted to tell you more than you wanted to hear and so forth. But I was a poor interrogator. I didn't interrogate. I interrogated a lot of interrogators. Oh, I did sometimes, of course. But I could never intimidate anyone, you see. And you had to be intimidating to be a proper interrogator, and they just laugh at me. I couldn't get anything out of anybody. Of course, all they had to tell me, of course, was name, right, and serial number. That was the Geneva Convention. That's all they had to tell me. But when you have to, they'll tell you anything you want. But I say there's no bitter feelings at all. I mean, usually the prisoners would come in with a sigh of relief. Thank heaven this is over. And they would write it in there. They had the passbooks. They were very instructive, those passbooks. Tell them where they'd been, what the unit was and everything. It's the passbook you wanted, and you could always get that from them. But they'd write in their passbook, "This day, the war ended for Hans Gelser. Three cheers. I'm going over to the Americans." And so as I said, and the same thing with the Japanese, who are our best friends, now our economic rivals, of course. But it was MacArthur who had built Japan, a very wise and generous thing he did. He proved his greatness in reinstating Japan without any rancor, as Lincoln said, with malice toward none, charity toward all. That's the way you have to do it. Well, if you're going to end that way, why bother killing everybody in the meantime then? Why not decide right at the beginning what you're going to do? I repeat, because it's very, very profitable. And there I could a tale unfold, I say, which I'm not going to. It wouldn't be healthy, actually. Well, we didn't finish the war story yet. But this is the time of which we are living, and yes, oh yes, well, I hear a bell. I go, the bell invites me. Hear it not, Duncan, for it is the knell that summons you to heaven or to hell.